Good evening. Okay, we're going to begin Perek Yud Ches. Pasuk Chof Aleph. We're right in the middle of the end of the recounting of the story of Pesel Micha. So what we saw last week, let's just recap. What we saw last week was that after Micha had put in all of his efforts, blood and sweat and tears, well, I don't know if there was that, but whatever it is, he set up this shrine and he hired his Choshev HaKoyin to officiate there. Along came these people from Dan, 600 warriors, and they carried off his beloved statue along with his Kayin. That was what we basically finished last week. They told the Kayin, here you're on a small scale position, you know, you're officiating for one man's shrine. Come with us, you'll become the chief idolater of Shevet Dan. You'll become the Kayin for the whole Shevet. And he goes off with them. This is basically what we concluded last week. He goes off with them without too many compunctions. As we've already seen, a very important principle in this man's life. A very important principle in this man's life was money. And the main principle was in place here. He was offered a better job, and he went off. Okay. So we've already pointed out, that this also is an element of understanding how the Yetzer Hara operates. And this is what we finished last week. We rushed as we finished last week, but I was just ended by saying, let's try to picture Micha's feelings. That he took this kid off the street and gave him a home and gave him a good job and cared for him. And we see that Micha was really very hospitable to him. Right? And then, all of a sudden, Micha sees not only is his statue being carried off, but the Levi is marching off along with them, looking very happy about himself. Why? Because someone offered him a better job. You know, we can imagine that Micha didn't feel very good about that. That there was that sense of betrayal. So once again, we say that many of these things are just insights into the way the Yetzer Hara operates. Makes you feel like he's your good pal. Right? Makes all kinds of things seem sweet to you. He's only out there for your good. He wants to have a good time. Person comes up, Rachmana Litzlan, to the Olam HaEmes, and there he sees the Yetzer Hara. Chazal tell us, the Yetzer Hara, who's Satan? The Yetzer Hara is the one standing there. He's the prosecuting angel. He had the sense of betrayal. He was so palsy-walsy in this world. You're the one who was luring me into all these things. And then he's the one standing there afterwards, completely turns his back on you, and he's ready to prosecute. So, it's good to realize these things in advance, and realize, no, the Yetzer Hara is not a friend. Now, wait a minute, who are we talking about when we say the Yetzer Hara? Who exactly is it? It's me who feels. So you have to realize, it's like the Chavis HaLavavah says, he was saying it in a more blatant way, but within each of us it operates in a much more subtle way. The Yetzer Hara, what you feel you want is really somebody else inside you. We've often told the story of Rabbi Levi Yitzchak of Vardichev, right? Rabbi Yitzchak of Vardichev was one time davening for the Yom, he went to be the chazan for the Yom Neroim, big shul in the city, and he goes up for Kol Nidre, puts on the tallis, he's not starting, and people in the shul are watching and they're waiting, and he's not starting. And they see he's busy, like he's shifting, and there's something going on at the Amud. And finally he takes off the talis, puts it down on the Amud, and he says, if you're such a tzaddik and you're also an Amud, you daven. And he walked away. And everybody was looking at him like, what happened to him? So he said, he was a young man. So he said, well, I was ready to daven for the Amud. And the Yetzer Hara came and told me, wow, look how prestigious, look how chashev, such a big kehila, you're the one davening for the Amud. That's why I said, Gaiva, how can I be thinking that? The Yetzer Hara said to me, oh, very good, see that? Not only are you the chazan, but you're also such an anav. So I said to the Yetzer Hara, you know what? If you're such a tzaddik and you're also such an anav, you daven. Took off the talis, put it on the amud, and walked away. Meaning, okay, it sounds like a cute little story, but there's really a very important point here. That often, the feelings that we identify as ourselves, I'm tempted to XYZ, we know it's the Yetzer Hara, but it's I want it. It's like the Chavos HaLevavos says, there's actually a foreign element, someone else, an enemy of yours, a hostile, call it person, being, inside you who works so well that he makes you feel like it's you. He mixes into your feelings. It's really him, but he makes it feel like it's you. That's what's so tricky here, right? And then, like, you have to be able to tell yourself, this isn't me. I don't want that. The Haraya, the truth, that you can see that you don't want it, because when you step back and you're considering the situation theoretically, let's say you're tempted, give an example, okay? Example that's not relevant to anybody, so I'm not stepping on anybody's toes. You walk by. I was just in Los Angeles, okay? So I'll give the example. You walk by one of these morning cafes, you smell the aroma of the pork chops being prepared for breakfast, and I was on my way to shul with a talis. I wouldn't have done to step in, but whatever it is, tantalizing smell of pork chops, person says, I want it. There's an inner struggle going on. I want it, right? So that's the point to realize, no, you don't want it. If you were to step back, if you wouldn't be there right now with the scent coming into your, tickling your nose, and you ask you in a general way, would you go in to have pork chops if it was tempting? No, I wouldn't want to do that, right? All of a sudden now when you're being tempted, it isn't you, you still don't want it. There's some other force that's mixed in. That's really an enemy. You feel like it's you who wants it. Somebody else is trying to convince you. You don't want it. Someone else is trying to convince you. Makes you feel so good about it, etc. No. He's waiting for you to fall, and then he'll be there to push the case against you. So you have to realize, Yetzer Hara is not just a slick operator, but he's a real traitor. He's a real betrayer. Right? And you don't want to go through that agony of seeing the one who was acting the whole time as your best friend, then standing and saying, oh, you thought it was you. Now you see clearly, no, that wasn't me. Now you see who it was, the one who was telling you, ooh, those pork chops are good. Or whatever it is, right? I'm using a far out example. Whatever it is, oh, that's good. And now you see that it's actually really somebody else who is just out to get you. So, this is a point to bring home. Obviously. So the truth is, as we'll see, why is there such a focus made out of this story? We'll see that there was not necessarily all that much Avodah Zarah going on at that time. As we go through the continuation of this perek, it's part of the point of this is to bring out, we often get the impression, because of the castigations of the Navi, that these eras were full of Avodah Zarah, the Jews were going off all the time. Actually, a big, important part of why this story is given so much stress is to show that actually, you know what, all those castigations, all the talk about how the Jews worshipped idols, etc., actually might have been addressing one specific instance. This instance. We'll see soon as we get to the end of the chapter. We have to realize, and this is a very important point that we should come away from with this chapter. Just a second. And again, we'll elaborate on this more. This sounds very surprising. But again, part of the point is to realize that the terms that the Navi uses, talking in a very blanket way, the Jews worshipped XYZ, might actually have meant that there was one person somewhere doing this. Or maybe there was a group of people. Here we see that it actually turned into a group of people. Whatever it is never, or almost never, as widespread as the impression that you get from the Navi. Part of the Navi's agenda was, what was his agenda? His agenda was to perfect the Jewish people. And part of that agenda was to take the smallest of problems and magnify them. As we said from the Gro the other day, the Gro said, this is how the Navi operated. When a woman wants to beautify herself, she takes a magnifying glass, she stands by the mirror and she takes a magnifying glass. So as to what? To blow up any blemish on her face. Why are you doing that? You want to look beautiful. Don't take a magnifying glass. Without the magnifying glass, you're much more beautiful. Now the answer is, no. If she wants to beautify herself, she wants to see every last blemish as clearly as possible in order to be able to deal with it. Otherwise, it's a simple solution. We turn the magnifying glass around the other way. Then she looks great. Can barely see her face. Tiny little face. You don't see anything. This was the Navi's job. We're going to see soon that actually, when you see these blanket statements, the Jews served Avodah Zarah, that might be talking about one instance that happened somewhere off in the middle of nowhere. But we'll see. We're going to bring that out more at the end of the parak.
Well, according to the understanding that Professor Nichol traveled through Yamsul and Hashem did all these miracles and fought all the wars with the presence of this Hassel, why was he in the time of Yeshua so intolerant of someone taking care of him?
Okay, so first of all, Nechemi is asking if the
Hassel was just great enough.
Okay, so Nehemiah is referring to a Chazal that says that actually the problems already started from Yamsuf, etc. So there wasn't a Pesel at that point. The Pesel was created now, as we saw in these Pesukim. Chazal say that he carried the paper that had the Shem Hashem on it, which he ultimately used to get the Pesel going. Okay? But at that point, nothing actually happened. Nothing had actually occurred. It was in potential. Hashem does not punish for potential. At least with Jews. So nothing had actually happened at that point. Okay, so now let's move on. By the way, I'll just add one more point to this last discussion from David Pavarsky, the famed Rosh Yeshiva of Panovich, Nifter about 20 years ago. He also brought out this point. He used to talk about Zelig. His Yitzhahara was Zelig. That's how he talked about it. Zelig had an argument with me the other day. Zelig was trying to do this and this. I don't know why Zelig, whatever it is, that's how he used to call Yitzhahara. Zelig, I got a visit from Zelig again yesterday. That's how he would talk. So it sounds kind of like cute, like, you know, calling the Yitzhahara Zelig. But the truth is there's a psychology here that would be good for us to internalize, to really learn to relate to the Yitzhahara as someone else. Things that we know, I feel tempted, I know it's the Yitzhahara, but I really want it. When you really learn to develop that reality where, no, Zelig wants it. What's that got to do with me? Zelig can jump in the lake. Right? It sounds silly, it sounds childish, but actually, when it goes on a regular basis, you get more used to operating that way. You learn more to identify these temptations as something that's actually coming from an outside source. It isn't really me. Okay, let's move on. Now, so these people of Dan are heading off with their statue and with their coin. Vayifnu vayelechu. And they turned and they left. Vayasimu es hatav es hamikna ves hakvuda lifneim. Now they realized that Micha is not necessarily going to take this sitting down. I mean, this is this man's life's project. Right? So, they prepared themselves for Micha to come fight. So therefore, Vayasimu es hatav, they sent ahead all of their children and their livestock, Vesakvuda, and their general luggage, Lifneim, ahead of them. They sent them ahead so that the group of 600 could just be ready for war without any encumbrances. They're ready for him to come fight. Hema hirchiku mi beis micha. They were going from the house of Micha. Vanashim asher babotim in beis Micha, and Micha got together his neighbors, taking his shrine. Nizaku, he rallied them together. Vayadviku es bnei Dan, and they chased the people of Dan. The people of Dan were prepared for this, and they wanted to get across to Micha. Not only are they going to keep his statue, but they're not even concerned about him. Meaning, they were going slowly. Again, we're talking about 600 men of war. They didn't make a point of running. They're not worried. Vayikru'el b'nei Dan. Meanwhile, Micha and his pals catch up with them and they call out to them, people of Dan. Vayasebu p'neyem. So the people of Dan turned around. The Mepharshim say that here also, the people of Dan were getting across to Micha. You don't scare us more than a mosquito. When people are going away and they're expecting to be pursued, they'd be looking over their shoulders. Because no, they didn't turn around. All of a sudden, they heard Micha calling to them. They like turned around. Oh, somebody's here. Okay. By a same name, so they turned around. Yeah, they kind of turned their face around. Someone say something, right? Vayomru leMicha, and they said to Micha, Malacha kinis akta, is something wrong, Michale? Why are you running? Something happened? Says Malacha, what is the problem? They asked him. Vayomer, so Micha says, Es Elohai asher asisi lekachtem, you took my God. In the Mefarshim note, what kind of God is that if you need your worshiper to stick up for you? But okay, you took my God. These are God kidnappers. Right? You know the story with Rabbi Anderson Eibishitz, by the way? One time one of these Christian priests came and said, accused him, he said, you killed our God. So Rabbi Anderson Eibishitz said to him, okay, so you kill ours. So this is basically what's going on here. So, you took my God, Betzakoyin, you took my Koyin too. Vatelchu, and you're heading off. Umali Oid, what do I have left in life? This is my pride, this is my nachas, this is my life's achievement, my statula. Umazen Tomuay Lai Malach, what are you coming and asking me, what's the problem? The problem is very clear. Vayomuay Lav B'nei Dan. So the people of Dan said to him, Michale, we have friendly advice for you. Al Tashma Kolcha, don't yell too loud. Imanu, don't yell too loud, because don't yell too loud, because among our group there are some hot-tempered guys. You don't want to get them upset. Friendly advice. Well, safta nafshecha v'nefesh beisecha. Friendly advice. Go back home. You'll be better off. You'll save yourself and your family. There are guys here that you don't want to get upset. Okay. Meaning, in short, they took his thing, made a joke out of him. Vayelchu b'nei don l'darko, and without even waiting for his response, they turned around and kept going. Vayar Micha, kichazokim heima mimenu. So Micha saw that he doesn't have a chance. He had a very small handful of people with him. He came with 10 guys. Okay, I guess he came with the guys from the minion that he had in his shrine. But whatever it is, he saw kichazokim heima mimenu, that they're stronger than him. Vayifen vayoshov el beisa. Turned around. And he went back home. That's the end. He lost his shrine. What's that? I'm afraid that the answer is, when we're talking about these people, okay, we're not talking about the whole Shevet here. We're talking about a group of 600 people. The answer, I'm afraid, is there weren't any. So, he turns around, he goes home. And that's that. As far as Micha is concerned, that is the end of the story. Soon we'll move on to Bnei Dan. But this is it. Exit Micha. Micha is finished. No more shrine. Now it's back to life. What's that? Oh, so Rabbi Didi is asking a good question. This is really what I was getting at. So what happens? That's it. He goes home. End of story. Next day he was back in shul like everybody else. Yaakov Mamleis brings this out. He didn't go home and make a new shrine. Didn't go home and make a new statue. He lost his statue, he was done. Meaning, at the time he opposed it, etc., but once he lost it, he lost it. And he was not going to go so far as to make a new one. Meaning, we have to remember that at the end of the day, Micha was a loyal Jew. Loyal. Okay. Kind of loyal. Right? But he was what you call centrist Jew. Okay? Between, he knew how to get the most of all worlds. But he was a from Jew, and he rationalized his idol, but there was always that uncomfortable feeling there, and therefore once it was gone, it was gone. He did not go back to it. Mamleis points out, he did not go back to it. And here Mamleis brings out a very interesting point. Lemaisel, how did it come about that Micha lost his idol, his statue? Because of the fact that his home was known as an inn, a place where you can come for free board and food. Like we've been stressing a few times, Micha was a big Baal Chesed. That was as important as his shrine was, he had another agenda in life, and that was Chesed. He had a home that was open to wayfarers. This is what caused the attention to be brought to his shrine, and this is really what brought the people of Dan there. So here's an example of, person was doing a mitzvah, got him into trouble. What did it? Huh? Oh, what happened? It was the schus of this mitzvah that got his avodah zarah taken away from him and got him back on track as a frum Jew. Got him back to shul, back to life as a frum Jew. He never engaged again in avodah zarah. What's that? Did he actually do tshuva? I'm not sure. But Aziv Asacheti did. He didn't engage anymore in avodah zarah. You see that? Yes, it was this schus. The person has his chus. I don't know where it's going to end up fighting for him, but that's what happened here. That chus of his chesed fought for him and actually saved him from a life of choyte umachte, a life of idol worship. Now, another point that Ma'am Loyes brings out here that's important to note is that, again, Micha did not get together more than a handful of people to help him out. So if so, Ma'am Loyes says it's important to note this, because this shows, and here's we're getting to what you were discussing. Micha's idol, Micha's statue did not attract many followers. He was hoping for a much larger membership. But membership was always very sparse. Didn't have enough people willing to fight for him. Again, in Klal Yisrael, with Klal Yisrael, didn't have enough followers, enough people who believed in it, enough people who took it seriously, to be interested in fighting for him. Even more than that, even in terms of just the Jews, as we'll see Pete later, they were very principled people. They would fight just injustice, but they weren't ready to stick up for him in this either. So, Ma'am Loyes says, and here again, we're getting back to your question. This gives us a perspective on quite how not widespread idolatry was among the Jewish people. Idolatry did not attract followers. Here's an idol, which apparently in terms of idols should have been attractive. People who did like idols appreciated it, they wanted it. But yet, for all the time that was sitting around the Micha's place, and with all the people that passed by, etc., he did not gain much of a following. The Jewish people were not involved in idolatry. And that's why, on the contrary, Micha's idol was one of the examples of the idolatry that the Nevi'im so much blamed the Jewish people for. In fact, Chazal say, David says, this is one of the classic expressions. The Russian of the Pasuk is Vayach Isu Bipsileim. And David is talking about the Jewish people. Vayach Isu Bipsileim. They angered Hashem with their idols. Again, it's one of these expressions that sounds like a very blanket expression. The Jews were angering Hashem with their idols. Chazal say, what's that referring to? This idol of Micha. Yes, the fact that there was a shrine somewhere with 10 to 20 followers, in the Navi's term, that's expressed as the Jewish people were angering Hashem with idol worship. To realize that. Coming up. Yeah, we'll see. So, we'll see this brought out more as we get towards the end of the parak. Let's move on. Back to the people of God. The Hema Lakhu, Es Asher Asa Micha, the people of Dan took Micha's statue, Vesa Koyin Asher Hoyoloi, and the Koyin that he had. Now let's remember, where were they going? They were going to this place called Laish, to attack it and to conquer it. Vayavayu al Laish, they approached Laish. Al Am Shaketu Boiteach. And there they came upon, as we said, a community of people dwelling quietly and securely. As we said, they had no connections with anybody around. This was a place in the middle of nowhere, and therefore it was just wide open for the Bnei Dan to come and attack and take it over. Vayaku oisam lefi choreb, they smote them by sword, ve'sa'ir sorfu ba'esh, and they burnt the city in fire. Oh, so what happened here? They wiped out the city, and then what? They burnt it down. Why did they burn it down? Hold them a farshim estes. Why did they burn it down? You have a built city? Take it! Why did they burn it? So the simple understanding, which many of the Mepharshim say, is that it was part of the war. It was part of the war. They needed to set the city afire in order to win. It helps generate panic, etc. Okay, fine. But listen to what the Radak says in his second shot. Now hold on to your seats. You know why they burnt the city down? because there were idols in it. There were idols in it. The Jews don't count it as idols. Alright? What's going on here? These people just robbed an idol and they're planning on setting up a shrine. They even have the kayin to officiate. It's all in place. They're burning down this whole city. They're not taking any loot. Why? It's got idolatry. The whole thing has to be burnt down. We don't want any part of it. What's going on here? So, this can be understood in a number of ways. First of all, as we've already said, it wasn't so clear cut. This wasn't mamish an idol. It wasn't like they believed in this and not in Hashem. They believed that you worship this because, as we said the other week, Hashem, it's easier to access Hashem's representatives than Hashem. Pray to an idol which represents certain heavenly forces and you can bring down hell, parnasa, whatever it is, each idol with its properties. So as we've said, that's a different category of idol worship. Now in terms of Torah, that is an idol. Right? A person who worships it must be put to death. But in terms of rationalization, it's not mamish an idol. Again, might not be the most halachically correct thing. Might not be lechatchila. Fine. But is it mamish an idol? These things were mamish idols. And idols, no, that absolutely not. But this, they were able to understand themselves. They were able to understand themselves. And therefore, yes, they were able to, second, they were able to zealously burn down an entire city so as not to have anything to do with any of its idols while they were actually busy importing their own idol into the city. Oh, so that's what we're saying. It was a very different category. The Canaanim didn't recognize Hashem. They had their idols, different gods in charge of different things, and there was no Hashem. That's real idolatry. You believe in this, you don't believe in Hashem. That's idolatry. But they believed in Hashem. They just... it's easier. Hashem is off in the long haul. Let's say you want Parnassa. Right? You have to daven a lot. You have to also maybe improve different areas of spirituality in order to earn Hashem's favor. It's a long haul. There are quicker ways of doing it. You approach one of the lower ministers. This idol represents the star of Parnassa. Okay? You come, you worship this idol, you get it quickly. Now we understand that it's frowned upon in halacha. We understand that it's frowned upon in halacha, but it's not that bad. Now again, at the end of the day, this too, the Torah defines as idol worship. But in terms of them being able to understand themselves, they were able to understand themselves. They were able to understand themselves. This also, again, an important point to bring home, just to be aware, to be conscious of the phenomenon, that often people operate this way, this paradox, with these paradoxes, that I understand myself very well. The other person's faults, I'm shocked and abhorred, right? But myself, I understand, even though other people might look at me in shock, but I know that it's really not that bad. But look at other people, there we really see the problem in its full glory. So another thing to note, how they're able to carry the idol into the town and yet burn down the town because of their absolute disgust from anything that has to do with idols. Okay.
Why didn't they just take the idols and burn the idols?
So this is part of the point. They were so repulsed that they just wanted nothing to do with anything in the city. Did it always work this way? Not necessarily. In fact, not. But this is what's going on here. Now they ain't matzil. So they smote the city and nobody came to oppose them to save the people. As we said the other week, these people were Sidonites. But they were far from Sidon, from the mainland of Sidon. So they weren't there to help them. And they didn't have any dealings with other people. They had no treaties with anybody. No one was interested in helping them. It was in a valley near a place called Beis Rechayv. After they burnt it down, they built up the city and they settled. So here we have to note another thing. This is a point that Chazal bring out. They had a smashing success, a smashing victory. Who provided that victory? Hashem. This was really just a part of the general picture of the Jews conquering Eretz Yisrael. Right? The Jews conquered Eretz Yisrael. Hashem had told them that he would assist their efforts. And here he assisted their efforts. Chazal say this is an example of what we say, Lecho Hashem Atztokav Alon and Boishas Aponim. They're carrying an idol, which they're ready to establish as a shrine in this town that they're going to establish now. And yet, Hashem says, but I'm still going to help you conquer the town and settle it. At the end of the day, he says, I'm not going to drop you because of that. I hope you'll do tshuva, etc. Maybe after a little bit of time, we will bring retribution. But right now, that doesn't necessarily do away with the whole picture. You need to settle the land. Hashem doesn't say, the idol doesn't change the whole picture. You need to settle the land and you need my care and help. You did an idol. Ooh, that's certainly, you'll be blamed for that. But, I'm not gonna just drop everything now. I'll still help you settle the land. I'm still caring for you. The idol will have to be addressed and dealt with. But, the land, Lamaisi, you'll be able to settle. I'm not forsaking you, I'm not abandoning you because of that. We look at that later in history, Chazal said. We looked at that later in history, and we look back and we say, L'cha Hashem atztok av alayonu boishas haponim. Look how ashamed we have to be. How Hashem, He promised us help, He's continuing to help us, even while we are spiting Him in His face.
Were these people of the Amun that we were instructed to destroy?
No, but it was part of the, there were two elements to conquering Eretz Yisrael. They were settling the land because the Jews need to be well settled in the land. Yeah, this is part of it. No. These people were people that had come from Chutz La'aretz, a branch of Tzidonim that set themselves up in Eretz Yisrael. Now, in terms of the command to wipe out the seven nations, they didn't have to be worried. But there was a different element, that the Jews should settle themselves comfortably in the land. It was two tracks, which in general coincided, but there were areas where they didn't coincide. This was part of the precept, even the command, we would say, of the Jews settling themselves in the land. There were also areas where the Jews were already comfortably settled, but yet the command to wipe out the Kanani applied. So, generally, wiping out the Kanani and settling the land went together. There were areas where it didn't overlap. This was one of those instances.
Didn't the land did it stop? We already got to the time that Hashem said, okay, it's the...
This was before that. Here we're talking Mamish in the early years, during the rule of Kushan Rishasayim, before Osniel ben Kenaz became Shoifit. Yeah. Yeah. This and the story of Pelegat Rigiva happened all the way at the beginning of Shoifit.
Were they given the option to surrender?
What's that?
Were they given the option to surrender?
I would assume so, but I don't know for sure.
Probably not.
Okay.
They looked for a place to settle.
I guess I would assume that was a question of technicality. If it would work to give them a chance to leave, maybe they would. If not, not. But I don't know. It's up for us to guess.
They couldn't give them time to get things together.
If technically they couldn't, then they probably didn't. If technically they could, they probably did. I don't know. They're saying it was a technical issue. Wouldn't be a... Okay. Now, Vayikru'u Shem Ha'ir Don. They called the place Don. B'Shem Don Avim. They named it after Dan, their father Dan, Ashiulad Yisrael, who was born to Yisrael. Thanks. Ulam Laish Shema Yolo Yishana, but Laish had originally been the name of the city. Okay, they settled. Now, Vayokimo Lahem Bnei Dan as Hapasam. The people of Dan established a statue once they settled down the land. Next thing was, okay, they set up the statue. The Ahinasan ben Gershom ben Menashe, and this Levi, Yahinasan ben Gershom ben Menashe, who ubanav hayu kayanim leshevet hadani, they served as the kayanim, the priests officiating at this statue for the people of Dan, ad yoim glois haaretz, until the exile of the land. This pasuk deserves a little bit of attention. So first of all, it's just, what is the pasuk saying? They set up the statue, and,
480
Well, let's see. Then they set up the statue.
No, another. So like close that out.
Let's see. Let's see. They set up the statue, and this Kayan and his children served, officiated at the statue until the exile. Which exile? What do we mean by the exile? This is not so clear. Because we know, if we're talking simply on the stool, we would say, what does the exile mean? This is what you're referring to. Exile means the exile, when they, the Chorban Beis HaMikdash. That can't be. Because there were plenty of kings in the interim who completely eradicated any Avodah Zarah from the land. So what exile are we talking about? So there are a few understandings here. And we'll mention the different shitas, just because each one has its different points. Ralbag says, this is a very, very short time here. The exile means until the first time they were really conquered by foreign rulers, which was in the days of Yavin, the king of Canaan, in the days of Devorah. Pretty early on in the history of the Shoftim. This wasn't very long lived. Didn't last very long. He says there were plenty of people throughout the years that the Jews were settled in Eretz Yisrael who would have eradicated it. So he says the exile means when Yavin, the king of Canaan, shortly into the period of the Shoftim, the time of Devorah, conquered Eretz Yisrael. We've seen back then that the Shevet of Dan actually fled from their territory during that time and settled in the Transjordan. So that's the exile we're referring to. They're the little isolated exile of the people of Dan back in the time of the Vayra. Okay. But there are other understandings which seem to be, these two other understandings seem to be the more mainstream ones. Rashi says, I want to conclude with the one that we'll be going with mainly. But number two is, Rashi says that it refers to Sancheirit. It doesn't refer to the Gullus all the way at the end, the Churban Beis HaMikdash, because as we already said, there were kings of Beis David that eradicated Avodah Zarah. But, in the territory of the 10 tribes, Micha's statue and shrine was able to survive. However, let's see. Now, even that has to be qualified somewhat because there were still periods in between where everything would have been eradicated. Shmuel did a cleansing job. David did a cleansing job. So therefore the Malbim says something interesting. He says that what happened was that this shrine was with the Shevet of Dan. When Shmuel came along, he got rid of it. And here's where we get into some more interesting information just about the people. When Shmuel came along, the shrine was closed down. Now, our Mr. Levi was left without Parnassa. As we've seen a few times, Parnassa was of utmost importance to this man. What job did he get after that? A fundraiser for a yeshiva? Oh, so what happened afterwards? So the Gemara says something very interesting. David HaMelech saw that this man is obsessed with money. So David said, you know what? He can channel that into good things. David made him listen to this. David took this man, the retired priest of, and he said, oh, I see you're a good money man. He made him the treasurer of the Beis HaMikdash. Made him his treasurer. Huh? David figured that the Yetzer Hara of money can be satisfied even through just dealing with money. That would be enough. And that was fine. Until, what happened? Shlaima came along and fired him. Shlaima did a general restructuring of administration. He fired him. So the Malbim says it was after that, subsequently, shortly after Shlaima's death, the kingdom split in two. The territory of the 10 tribes was developed. And then, for lack of Parnassi went back to his good old job. He went, he reopened his shrine, and there it was until the 10 tribes were exiled. That's Rashi's understanding. And then we have the understanding of And then we have the understanding of the Radak and the Mitzudas, which I think is the most, In between, right? Then we have the Radak and the Mitzudas, who I think, I find this easiest to work with. That's the way I'll term it. I find this pshat easiest to work with. And he says, no, until the exile of the land means until the war in the days of Eli. Meaning, yes, Eli. Yeah, let's see. Basically, they put this into the perspective that seems to work best with all the different Ma'amari Chazal on the subject. According to my limited understanding, this is one that I connect to best. So that, yes, this shrine was existent all the days of the Shoftim and no more. It started at the beginning of the days of the Shoftim and it went all the way to the end of the days of the Shoftim. We'll see soon. Now, what happened at the end of the days of the Shoftim? What exile are we referring to? The second to last Shofet was Eli. He was the Shofet before Shmuel. Okay? In Eli's days, there was a big battle with the Pelishtim. The Pelishtim conquered the Aron. That was a very, very down point for the Jewish people. That's the exile we're referring to. It survived until that exile. It was at that time that Eli died. Shmuel took power. Once Shmuel came, he got rid of it and it was gone ever since. So in other words, according to this understanding, and this really seems to be what most fits with many other elements here, this was here all throughout the period of the Shoftim until the time of Shmuel, who came along and got rid of it.
But the Kohen did not make it all afterwards also.
What's that?
Tell the thing with Shlomo Melech
Yehoshua. Yeah, but that might have been on a private level, whatever it is, we don't know, not necessarily in this way. Shimshon? No, Shmuel was the last Shoftim. Shmuel was the last Shoftim. What's that? Oh, so let's see. So now let's finish the last pasuk. Vayasimu lahem es pesel micha asher asa, and they established this statue of micha that he made. Kol yemei heyos beiso elokim b'shilah, all throughout the days that the house of Hashem was in Shilah. Meaning, really, what the pasuk is saying is as follows. It is really why this. So this last pasuk is giving you a perspective of what the significance of this whole story was. All throughout the days of the Shoftim, you had the Mishkan in Shiloh, and you had the Mishkan's counterpart, if we'll call it that. There was another place where there was service going on. There was the Shrine of Micha. These two, Lahavdil, were operating parallel to each other. The way Chazal term it is, the smoke came up from the Mizbeach in Shiloh, the smoke came up from the shrine in Micha, and as it went to Shemayim, the two smokes mixed together and came up before Hashem and angered him. That's the way Chazal put it. Meaning, this incident, which began as a private affair in the house of a weirdo, turned into something that was a thorn in the side of the Jewish people, whether they realized it or not. There was always a spiritual impediment extant that was countering the effect of the Mishkan and Shiloh, causing problems whether they were aware of it or not, caused wars, caused persecution, caused problems with Goyim, etc. The whole time there was something that just wasn't letting things run right. That was the Pesel Micha. Yes, as we already saw, this was a very small scale. It didn't have a large following. But yet, the fact that it was there, and the fact that it was not wiped out, constituted a thorn in the side of the Jewish people all throughout the period of the Shoftim. Again, it's quite possibly literal that the smoke mixed together. But they're saying it also in a general way, that all of the achievements of that period were always sullied with the fact that at the same time there was the Pesel Micha. And very great people at different points. Very great people, very great achievements. It was a golden period. But the whole time, there was always that Pesel Micha, an eyesore, ruining the effect of all the great things that was going on. Ruining completely? No, not ruining completely. The achievements were very great. But it was always undermining, diluting the effect, etc. And as we'll see soon, Hashem held the Jewish people accountable for this. So, the reason this story is brought in, this is what Amalia says, how you have to realize what started off as a small little thing. A weirdo. Made a little shrine. Who cares? Nobody takes it seriously. The guy's a Meshuggah anyways. Then what was the next step? It turned into a Shevet-wide thing. at that point, it was probably already more problematic to eradicate it, even if someone would have chosen to do so. Once you're already dealing with the bulk of Shevet, this certainly was not all of Shevet Dom. We already saw this was a certain family within Shevet Dom, these 600 people. But it was already more complicated. So there's a twofold lesson being brought out here. First of all, from the perspective of Micha, don't think that just a little Avera, what would be, you never know where it's going to get to. Once you do an Avera, you will be held accountable for the consequences, for the ripple effect, even though you say, I never dreamed it would go anywhere like that. That's not a claim. If you did everything you're supposed to do, and unfortunate things developed, we say, if you were doing everything you're supposed to do, you're not held accountable. Once you did something wrong, you opened up the door for the Yitzhahara to come in, you can't say, well, I thought I would throw him out after a minute. Once you let him in, you're responsible for all the damage he causes. Rav Shabtai Levitch's marshal on this idea. Let's say you see a person standing on the top of a skyscraper, he's about to jump. And you say, you're nuts, you're going to kill yourself. He says, no, I don't plan on jumping all the way down, I just want to drop one floor, it's faster than the elevator. No. Once you drop, you go all the way down. Right? So he was saying, once you let the Yitzhara in a crack, there's no telling where it's going to go. And this message is leveled also toward the Jewish people. Initially, there's a shtickle of the Zara developing, but again, they didn't attribute enough importance to it to see a need to come and violently eradicate it. But he told once again, a problem starts, blot it out while it's small. Don't wait for it to get big. As soon as you see something starting to develop, that's the time to stamp it out. And the fact that they didn't was held against them. Now, the true perspective on this story, we'll see next week when we start addressing the story of Pilegesh Begiva. Pilegesh Begiva is one of the most sensitive stories in Sefer Shoftim, which has to be understood very well. And this story, in a big way, is a preface to what we're going to see then. So we'll save that for next week.